set against a backdrop of lucerne and elberon, broad elm trees and leafy arbors, red damask and paneled walls, and coffee streaming from a spout of silver into bright, fragile cups. Smith spent his youth in the Fourth Ward, a wilderness of tenements stretching away from the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge. His grandparents had come to Earth in that ward for no better reason than that they happened to see a rooms-to-let sign hung out only a few blocks from the Beekman Street Pier where they were deposited in 1841 by the Black Ball Line, along with a shipload of other ragged Westmeath Irish, and they were too hungry and too tired to walk farther. They lived all the rest of their lives in the Fourth Ward. Al Smith's parents lived there, too, and Al Smith, who was born over a barber shop at 174 South Street on December 30, 1873, was to spend all his youth and young manhood in the shadow of the bridge, within an enclave, its borders sharply defined on the south by Water Street, where the tenements were crammed with prostitutes, and on the west by the Bowery, which was lined with flophouses and saloons, held tenaciously by the ward's respectable Irish families. Never leaving it for longer than a day's outing, he grew up in the narrow compass of a neighborhood whose life revolved around two institutions, St. James Roman Catholic Church and the downtown Tammany Club, and in which, as one who worked there put it, morality was simple. Virtue was virtue, vice was vice. And the views of the parents were the views of the children as to which was which. On summer evenings, the children would sit on the stoops of the tenements and talk until Father Keane rapped on the window of the St. James Parish House as a signal that it was time to go to bed. And they went, as their parents had gone when they were children and Father Keane's predecessor, Father Farrelly, had rapped for them. Bob Moses was neither circumcised nor bar mitzvah, but young Al Smith was a faithful St. James altar boy, awakening early on bleak, cold winter mornings, with his mother always up even earlier to prepare his breakfast, and trudging up Cherry Hill in the dark to serve at the 6 o'clock Mass. At the age at which Bob Moses was being led on horseback along Dwight Street and taken for walks in Central Park, Al Smith was scampering along the hectic Lower East Side waterfront, playing hide-and-seek among the bales and crates that cluttered the East River piers, dangling daringly from the sailing ship's bowsprits that made a line of spears over the horse-drawn trucks clattering along the cobblestones of South Street, playing tag during an era in which the city didn't build playgrounds in slums, in narrow side streets, or in the wider cleared spaces alongside the big, smelly fish market at the foot of Fulton Street, and tobogganing in winter down streets left uncleared of snow by a city that didn't bother to plow the slums. When he learned to swim, he learned in the river, with the spars of the sailing ships looming overhead and garbage floating on the water. Al Smith never went to Central Park. That was regarded by the neighborhood as a preserve for the wealthy. Uptowners, the Fourth Ward called them, who would send their Eton-collared children to its quiet glades with private tutors. His idea of an outing was the downtown Tammany Club's annual picnic, for which hundreds of sweating neighborhood families and cases of beer, candy, ears of corn, ice cream, and cheap toys were loaded into huge wagons for the 9-mile trip to Sulzer's Harlem River Park at 126th Street. At the age at which Bob Moses was being taught by private schools and private tutors, Al Smith was being taught by the good nuns of the St. James Parochial School and trying to avoid Father Keane's stern eye. And while Moses' tutors reported that he was brilliant, the nuns had a very different story to tell about the Smith boy. As one chronicler put it, "The boy had no great fondness for books and showed no inclination to study. He never cared much for school. A passing mark was all he ever desired and all he ever achieved." And he didn't always achieve that. Al Smith had bright, cheerful eyes and an appealing smile, but there was only one characteristic that set him apart from his classmates, his unusually loud voice. It was no surprise to the nuns that he won medals in citywide parochial school public speaking contests. At the age of 13, he didn't have to worry about school anymore. Moses' father retired young, but Smith's, a large, powerful Civil War veteran of thundering voice and an inexhaustible supply of funny stories and many friends, had to work too hard. Driving his own truck, loading and unloading heavy cargoes, he would come home no matter how cold the day, so wet with sweat that his first move would be to peel off his shirt and undershirt and plunge his face and arms into a tub of cold water to cool off. He worked 6 or 7 days a week, and often he got home so late that there would be days and nights on end when Al would not see the father who liked to put his little boy on his knee during family excursions to the beer gardens along the Bowery, regale him with stories, and let him sneak sips of his beer. In 1885, the father's health broke, and, unable any longer to do manual work, uneducated and with no skills, he was forced to take work as a night watchman. One by one, he had to sell his horses and finally his truck, but the proceeds of the sales were soon eaten up by doctor's bills and medicine. In November 1886, he died. All he left his son was his self-assurance. It was only through the charity of his friends that funeral expenses were paid. Al's mother was left almost penniless. Walking back from the funeral to the small flat, alone except for Al and his 10-year-old sister Mary, she muttered, half to herself, "I don't know where to turn." Mary heard her brother say, "I'm here. I can take care of you." At first, determined to keep her son in school, Al's mother refused to let him work. The very evening of the funeral, holding her children by the hand, she went to an umbrella factory and got a job that she could start the next morning. Rising before dawn to get breakfast for her children and prepare their lunches, Al's mother would work until dark at the factory and then come home to make supper and clean the flat. Since the salary she earned at the factory wasn't enough to support three persons, she asked for piecework that she could do at home, and when Al closed the door to his bedroom to go to sleep at night, he would see her bending over the work. A frail woman, within months, her own health was affected, and she had to leave the factory. With the help of friends, she opened a tiny grocery and candy store in the basement of the building in which the Smiths lived, but it quickly became obvious that the store would never provide enough to support the family. She could get charity, she knew, but widows who were unable to support their children had the children taken away and placed in institutions. She had heard about the institutions. Anything was better than that. A few months after his 13th birthday, a month before he would have graduated from St. James, which had only 8 grades, Al Smith left school and went to work. First he was a newsboy, then a chaser for a trucking firm, spending his days on the run, taking assignments for the firm's drivers from the main office and trying to find the drivers in the streets of the Lower East Side so that they would not have to waste time returning to the office. The job paid $3 a week. In the evenings, he tended counter at the little store while his mother rested. After 2 years, with income from the store dwindling and the family desperate, he became a shipping clerk for $8 a week. 2 years later, with the intake from the store down to almost nothing, he looked for another job and finally found one that would pay him $4 more. The job was at the Fulton Fish Market. Al Smith rolled heavy barrels of fish in and out of the market, put the fish on ice, cleaned them, and wrapped them. He worked from 4 o'clock in the morning until 5 in the afternoon, except on Friday. On Friday, he started work at 3. Returning home at night, tired and dirty and reeking of fish, he scrubbed off the odor and went downstairs to the store. But in the 1890s, $12 a week was almost enough to support a mother and a sister. He stayed at the market for 4 years. Then, to increase his pay to $15, he became a laborer, carrying heavy pipes at a pump works. It wasn't until 1896, when he was 22 years old, that he got his first political job. Moses and Smith came to public service not merely out of different backgrounds, but with different attitudes and for different reasons. Not even Al Smith's best friends ever said that he went into politics to help the lower classes. He went because, perhaps, he was gregarious, and politics for a young man in the Fourth Ward without connections was, in its early stages, mostly hanging around the downtown Tammany Club or Tom Foley's Saloon with other young men, drinking beer, singing around a piano, and telling stories while waiting for a contract from Foley. He went because, perhaps, it was a natural course for a young man with little education who wanted to get ahead in the ward's politics-drenched atmosphere, and because, perhaps, he saw no other way out of a life that for most of the years he could remember had been rolling heavy barrels and lifting heavy pipes. Moses prepared for his career by passing examinations and writing a thesis. Smith prepared for his by executing contracts. A contract, to Tammany Hall, was something to be done, an assurance to a local undertaker that Tammany would pay for a loyal Democrat's funeral even if his family could not, a discreet visit to a brothel to warn of an upcoming police raid, or to police headquarters to ease business-cramping parking restrictions in front of a liquor store belonging to a heavy campaign contributor. In the Fourth Ward, contracts were given out by Foley, one of the most remarkable of the Tammany district leaders who ran their districts and looked after the welfare of the straight-ticket-voting Democrats in them, as English squires looked after the welfare of their country villages. Big Tom was a square-shaped, mustachioed, quiet man who spent most of each day at the downtown Tammany Club listening to the cries for help, for a boy who had been arrested, for a process server who had been fired, for a policeman who had been shifted to a Staten Island beat, with unfailing patience. Although his saloons thrived, he was to die a poor man, their profits trickling, along with the payoffs and the campaign contributions, through his fingers into those of his constituents. The only payment he ever asked for the favors he dispensed was a straight Democratic vote, and so heartily were his constituents willing to make this form of repayment that his district regularly rolled up Democratic majorities that made him the most powerful district leader in the city. Born to wealth that he believed would make him always independent, Moses felt no compulsion to turn associates into friends. Arrogance is, after all, one of the coefficients of money. Arrogance would have been an unaffordable luxury to Smith. The equation of politics as he knew it contained a factor of friendship that had at least as heavy a weight as the factor of respect. In the evenings, after work, Smith began to hang around the saloons or the Tammany Club, hoping that Foley would give him a contract, and when he was given one, he executed it with graciousness and tact. Some of the historians who would later analyze his career would speculate that, as one put it, he made an effort, he trained himself, to be more than ordinarily helpful and obliging. Friends would deny it, saying that there had been something in his nature that had made him, even as a young boy, friendly and eager to assist someone in trouble. Whether it was natural or cultivated, as Al Smith executed the contracts, he displayed a gift for getting along with people that was so highly developed as to be almost genius. Joining the St. James Players, who put on plays to support the parish's orphanage, studying acting from the cheapest seats in the highest balconies at Broadway theaters, he became the parish's star villain, playing Corey Kinchella in Dion Boucicault's The Chagrin so enthusiastically that children began jokingly to hiss him when they saw him on the street. Everyone in the neighborhood seemed to know the slim, clean-cut youth with the soft smile and the loud, happy laugh, and everyone seemed to like him. Older men were watching him now. Father Keane liked to tell how Smith had tried to refuse to play any more villains. The hisses in the street were becoming louder, he had complained, and in the last production, when he had snarled at the girl who refused him, "You will yet be mine," the boos and catcalls from the gallery had annoyed him. He was going to be a hero or nothing next time, he had said. But all that had been necessary was for the father to call him in and say, "Alfred, we have over 200 little girls in the orphanage, and it is getting harder every year to feed and clothe and care for these girls." And Alfred had said simply, "Give me the part." When touchy matters, such as visits by respectable parish girls to neighborhood saloons with their dates, had to be brought up with the young people, the father began to look to Smith to do it, Somehow, when Smith handled it, not only did the visit stop, but nobody became hurt or angry. He had joined the Seymour Club, a social organization founded by a wealthy old grocer and Tammany financial backer named Henry Campbell. Campbell began looking to Smith to organize club excursions. Then he began inviting him home for Sunday dinners, and in 1896, when there became available a city job as a server of jury notices that paid $900 a year, Campbell saw that Smith got it. In 1900, after promising her parents that he would never become a professional actor, Smith married Catherine Katie Dunn, and the couple took a flat in the neighborhood, Smith's mother moving to Brooklyn to live with Mary and her husband. The children, there would be five, came quickly, and Smith's devotion to his family became a joke, a fond joke, among the people in the ward who saw him wheeling one child and holding the hand of another as he and Katie walked across the Brooklyn Bridge every Sunday after church, rain or shine, to visit his mother. But in the evenings, after supper, Al Smith left his family and went down to the clubs and saloons. And now another man was watching the youth, whom everybody liked, Tom Foley. Signing him up as a campaign speaker, Foley soon saw that even in this heartland of Irish platform eloquence, Smith was something special. And more important, he saw that Smith could be counted on. His praise of a Democratic candidate's personal qualifications was just as fervent whether he knew the candidate or not. To the other adjectives with which men described Smith, Foley added one that, in the lexicon of the democracy of New York City, had a special significance. Smith was, he said, regular. In 1903, he offered him a nomination for state assemblyman. Proving to be a remarkable campaigner, even though in Foley's districts remarkable campaigning was not a necessity for Democratic candidates, in November 1903, a month before his 30th birthday, Al Smith won his first election. Katie tied two brooms upright on the iron railings that lined the six steps to the doorway of the tenement in which the Smiths lived. It was a traditional gesture in the neighborhood, symbolizing a clean sweep by Tammany. Inside, in his living room, holding his mother's hand as he accepted congratulations, Alfred E. Smith, red-faced and loud in victory, resplendent in a new suit with wide-set, broad pinstripes, a tie that matched his voice, and a pearl stick pin, a big black cigar tilted cockily up from the corner of his red, wet lips, seemed the typical, regular Tammany brave. Yet what lurked behind the war paint? Al Smith went to Albany unprepared to be a legislator, or even to sleep away from home. On his first night in the Capitol, he noticed a large fire blazing in the fireplace of his hotel, saw that the room to which he and another new Tammany assemblyman, Tom Coughlin from Battery Dan Finn's district, had been assigned was not near any exits, and was so worried that the hotel would burn down and they would be trapped that he made Coughlin spend the night playing pinochle so that they would be awake for any emergency. Arriving in the assembly chamber the next morning, he was bewildered by the formalities of the opening session and was shunted by leaders who had no time even to talk to him to a desk so far from the speaker's podium that he often couldn't hear the rulings. When he did hear, he often didn't understand. Overcome by the intricacies of the legislative process, he sat day after day in the high-ceilinged chamber in silence. During the whole session, he did not make a single speech. He was not appointed to a single committee. Worst of all were the bills. Every morning when he arrived at his desk, there would be a pile of new ones a foot high. He would try the one that looked simplest, perhaps an act setting the maximum size of vehicles using public highways. "The provisions of this subdivision," he read, "shall not apply to vehicles and implements or combinations thereof not over 13 feet in width and designed and intended for use solely for farm purposes when owned or in the possession of a dealer in farm implements and equipment and within a radius of 50 miles of the principal place of business of such a dealer, including transportation of such vehicles, implements, and combinations thereof as a load on another vehicle, such vehicle or load not to exceed 13 feet in width during the same period and under the same conditions and restrictions as herein before in this subdivision provided for such vehicles and implements and combinations thereof when used solely for farm purposes. This was the simplest. The one underneath it might be 11 pages long, beginning, "Without limiting the generality of the following provisions of this section, property owned by the city and property used for transportation purposes exclusively pursuant to the provisions of a joint arrangement or of a joint facilities agreement or trackage rights agreement shall all be exempt from special ad valorem levies." The next one might be 13 pages, and it might start, "Paragraph H of Subdivision 6 of Section 235 of the Banking Law, as last separately amended by Chapters 46, 51, and 585 of the Laws of 1899, is hereby amended to read." As he sat there staring down at the desk, a page boy would deposit another pile of bills on it. The wording was difficult enough for the expert. It might have been designed to mock a man whose schooling had ended in the eighth grade, who had never liked to read even the simple books of childhood, who, he had said once, had in his entire life read only one book cover to cover, The Life of John L. Sullivan. As far as the course of the Empire State was concerned, it did not seem to matter if Al Smith understood the bills or not. The Democrats, a badly outnumbered minority in the Senate and Assembly, a party that had not elected a governor since 1893, had no real say in the state's affairs. Most of the Democratic legislators, understanding this, and understanding that in the rare instances in which their votes were important, they would be told how to cast them by their leaders back in New York, took their jobs with the lightness they felt they deserved. They spent their evenings in the Gut, a strip of whorehouses and cheap saloons down the hill from the Capitol. Smith, whose devotion to Katie was, and remained always, legendary as long as he lived, had no interest in the whorehouses, but he loved to sit with his fellow assemblymen in the saloons and drink beer and sing, and, when he worked up his nerve, tell a joke or two. As often as they, rousted out of a saloon by the assembly sergeant-at-arms for a vote, he would appear in the chamber with his derby over one ear. His clothes were of the same cut, his voice as loud, his language as crude. In appearance, he was one of them. But late in the evenings, when the parties were still loud, Al Smith would leave the saloons, and as he left, his steps would quicken. Hurrying back to his tiny furnished room in a cheap boarding house, he would sit down at a rickety desk. On the desk, he would earlier have piled the bills that had been introduced that day. Al Smith would begin reading them. Not only the bills which bore on a subject in which he was interested, and not only the bills which dealt with his assembly district, and not only the bills which dealt with New York City. Sitting at the rickety desk in the furnished room, Smith read all the bills, even those which concerned the construction of a side road or a tiny dam in some remote upstate district. And as he read them, he tried to understand them. Why had one legislator included in a bill a provision that the dam be built by the Conservation Department rather than by the Department of Public Works? What had been in the mind of another that led him to specify that the side road must be surfaced with a specific type of asphalt? Later in the night, Smith would hear bursts of song and laughter as the other legislators left the saloons. One by one, if he looked out the window in his room which faced the Capitol, he could see the lights in the huge gray building go out. Still, the man who had never liked to read read on. It must have seemed like the most useless of exercises. In his second term, he was appointed to two committees, but they were the Committee on Banks and the Committee on Public Lands and Forests, and, as he remarked in later years, "I had never been in a bank except to serve a jury notice, and I had never seen a forest." Again, he did not make a single speech during the entire session. The Democratic leaders had no interest in him except for his nod of assent at the end of a discussion. And the expenses of living in Albany, for which legislators received no reimbursement, ate up an assemblyman's $1,500 salary. By May, all except $250 was gone, and 7 incomeless months stretched ahead of him. In despair, he told Foley he didn't want to run again. "Meet me at Holtz's for breakfast tomorrow morning," Foley said. Over ham and eggs, Foley offered Smith another job, New York City Superintendent of Buildings. Smith's eyes lit up. Foley's were narrow. Watching the younger man closely, he said, "If you take the job, of course, you'll never be a big man in this town. I gave you a start toward being one. It's tough for a beginner in Albany. You can't learn what you need to know up there in a couple of years. But you're learning, and you've got great popularity in the district. I think you're on the right track, and I'm willing to stick with you if you want to go back. But maybe you ought to chuck it." "Maybe," Big Tom Foley said, "you're right in thinking that Albany is too tough for you." Foley said he would give Smith a week to think it over. In a week, Smith said he wanted to go back. When he went back, he read harder. Since most of the bills amended or referred back to other bills passed years before and not described in the new bills, he took to spending evenings in the legislative library reading those old bills. Since some of the most confusing wording was based on legal technicalities, Smith began to borrow law books from law libraries and take them back to the furnished room with him. Sometimes, leafing through the thick volumes, he thought wryly that their very appearance would have intimidated him a few years before. Tired of listening to speeches he couldn't understand, he would pay clerks for transcripts and study the transcripts. Near the end of the session, the annual appropriations measure, hundreds of pages long, containing tens of thousands of items, was published. No one, so far as anyone in Albany could remember, had ever read the entire appropriations bill. In 1906, Al Smith read it. Now, he was to say later, Albany began to make some sense to him. But he kept that fact to himself. Years later, Foley would say, "He would never admit that he knew anything about a subject until he knew everything about it." To his fellow legislators, he was still the typical Tammany regular. He cleared his votes with Foley, never argued with the leaders, and instead of making speeches, saved his voice for the nightly singing in the saloons. He had many friends in Albany now. He arrived at the Capitol each morning with a fresh supply of jokes, hilarious stories told in a variety of dialects, and legislators and clerks would crowd around him to hear them. During a debate on a bill proposing to regulate Chinese laundries, Smith suddenly burst into the assembly chamber bearing a huge sign decorated with Chinese characters. Surprisingly, his friends included Republicans as well as Democrats. No one would have seemed less likely to get along with the aristocratic upstate Republicans, born into families that controlled the great utilities and banks of the state and educated among the ivy, than Al Smith. But his jokes had them roaring, too. The rising star of a band of reforming Republicans who were trying to unseat the Black Horse Cavalry was young Jimmy Wadsworth, a scion of one of the wealthiest families in Rochester and a former Yale baseball star. Wadsworth soon began to make a regular supper trio with Smith and a slow-talking, forceful, young German-born state senator who had become particularly close to Smith, Robert F. Wagner, Sr. Elected Speaker, Wadsworth handed Smith some choice committee assignments. In 1908, after Smith had swept his district for the fifth time, he found himself, on his return to Albany, one of the Capitol's most influential Democrats. He was expected now to use the voice that he had kept silent so long. And when he did, people began to listen. The years spent reading the obscure minor bills began to pay off. Because no matter what the subject was, the other legislators began to realize, Al Smith understood it. In some way that they were unable to figure out, he had become familiar with their little pet projects, their side roads, the peculiar problems of their districts. Moreover, when Smith rose to speak, the assembly chamber became a place of drama. His presence electrifies and wins over even his opponents, Dean Christian Gauss of Princeton University was to say. His voice makes his listeners tingle. The voice was nasal, grating, harsh, and insistent, and unforgettable. One journalist wrote that it had trumpets in it. Coupled with the wit of the man who used it, it could tear an opponent apart or make bored men roar with laughter. A Buffalo assemblyman once tried to correct Smith's grammar. The assembly, well aware of Smith's lack of education, waited silently for his reply. Slowly, he arose. "I will," he said with dignity, "refer the gentleman from Buffalo to the rule that says, when a pluperfect adjective precedes a noun, insert a plus." It could even hold the attention of the legislators during arcane discussions of state finances. One reporter wrote, "Discussions of the annual appropriation bill used to be the signal for a general exodus from the assembly chamber, but not so when Al Smith took the floor. He could keep the members in their seats hours on end with his masterly dissection of that measure." Charles F. Silent Charlie Murphy, the unsmiling Irishman who had risen from saloon keeper to the leadership of all Tammany Hall, had been hearing a lot about Smith. Now he said he'd like to meet him. After the meeting, someone said to Murphy, "He's a nice young fellow. He has a lot of ability. It's too bad he isn't a college man." Murphy looked at the speaker a long moment. "If he was a college man," he said at last, "he wouldn't be Al Smith." In 1911, aided by revelations of widespread corruption among Republican legislators, the Democrats won control of both houses for the first time in 18 years. Murphy had the Democratic caucus elect Smith majority leader of the assembly. In a position of importance at last, Al Smith carried out orders. Using the powers of his office ruthlessly, he rammed through the assembly, as Bob Wagner was ramming it through the Senate, the notorious Murphy Charter, which weakened New York City's civil service system and added thousands of patronage jobs to its payroll. Good government groups railed at Smith. The Citizens Union called him one of the most dangerous men in Albany, identifying him day after day as Smith, the Tammany man. Newspapers joined in the outcry. "The Democratic caucus," said a disgusted editorial in the New York World, "is Charles F. Murphy at one end of a telephone wire and the Democratic leader at the other end." In all his years in the legislature, one political observer was to say, Smith had never been anything more than the brilliant henchman at Albany of the organization housed in the ornate and shabby building on 14th Street. But such analyses were incomplete. Most legislators spent as little time as possible in Albany, coming to the Capitol only 1 or 2 days a week and spending the rest of their time attending to their outside business interests. Murphy saw to it that Smith was offered a well-paying position with a firm doing business with the city. Finances were still tight for Smith. He could have used the money, but he turned the offer down. Instead, he spent most of every week, all of many weeks, in the Capitol. Not only did he attend every hearing held by every committee of which he was a member, but, legislators began to notice, he would slip quietly into hearings held by committees of which he was not a member and sit in the back of the hearing rooms, following the testimony intently. At night, he would still party loudly and happily, and he would still slip away from most parties early. Now he would slip away not to a cheap furnished room, but to the plush majority leader's suite at the Tenaik Hotel. Now the face bent over the pile of bills was considerably fuller than the face that had been bent over the pile 7 years before. It was redder, and its teeth, once so white, were capped with gold and yellowed by the cigar butts clenched unendingly between them. Now there was a considerable paunch beneath the pinstripes. But the face still bent over the bills. And now a new element was added to the background of the picture. Sweatshops didn't close on Saturday, and on the Saturday afternoon of March 26, 1911, hundreds of employees at the Triangle Shirtwaist Company, most of them girls from the Lower East Side, were still bending over swatches of material on the 8th, 9th, and 10th floors of a building overlooking New York's Washington Square. Someone in the 10th floor workroom lit a cigarette and tossed the match away. It hadn't burned out when it fell into the ankle-deep litter around the sewing machines. There was a puff of smoke and then a sheet of flame. The exits were inadequate, the doors to many locked. As the terrified girls jammed against them in panic, scores were crushed to death. Others were suffocated by the heavy smoke. As it billowed around them and the flames crept closer, girls leaped from the windows. Bodies smashed against the sidewalks and tore through sidewalk gratings. The death toll was 141. Reformers had been haranguing against unsafe conditions in the sweatshops for years, but their harangues had thudded without effect against political stockades buttressed with campaign contributions of factory owners. Now they descended on Albany, led by men like Henry Moskowitz, a bunch of near-hysterical women, and one very quiet one, Henry Moskowitz's wife. Demanding the formation of a commission to investigate factory conditions and to recommend remedial legislation, the reformers brought with them a list of potential commission members. Smith, conferring with them, agreed to most of the names, but added one, his own. At first, the reformers on the State Factory Investigating Commission looked at Smith the Tammany Man askance. Then the commission's work began. It took the members to all the major cities of the state. Now and again, one or another of the reform members would miss a trip, but they noticed that Smith never did. They watched his face as day after day he saw what life in the factories was like. They watched his expression when he saw whole families, mothers with their children, little boys and girls, working all the daylight hours 7 days a week in rooms in which there was not a single window, when, after one factory manager had insisted that no children under the age of 7 were employed in his plant, commission staffers found such children jammed into an elevator that had been hidden between floors to escape the commission's notice. When the reform members of the commission made their proposals, they waited for Smith's reaction. "You make the proposals," he told them. "I'll fight for them." Even while good government organizations were continuing to rail against him, the 1912 Citizens Union summary of his record was even more devastating than its 1911 summary, a few reformers were starting to tell their friends another story. Al Smith, they said, had absolutely no general theory. His naivete in matters of philosophy was ridiculous. When he talked about social welfare legislation, it was in terms of us against them, of the people against the interests, of the Fourth Ward against the factory owners. But the people, the Fourth Ward, did seem to mean something very special to him. No one could listen to him talk about how doctor's bills could eat up a man's savings and leave his family destitute, about how penniless mothers feared that the charities would take their children, about children who grew to manhood without ever having a pair of new shoes, without believing that his determination to help them was real. No one could look at his face when he talked and not know it was real. First one and then another of the reformers began to tell their friends that they had really come to believe that maybe, just maybe, after decades of waiting, reform in New York had found at last in the red-faced Tammany henchman the instrument for which it had been waiting, the champion who would fight for their dreams in the political arena and turn them into laws. And some of the more romantic among them, examining Smith's long, slow rise through the ranks of Tammany, began to speculate that perhaps all the time he had been executing its dirty work, he had been waiting for the chance to do good. When the commission's recommendations, embodied in bills, came up in the legislature, Smith fought for them. From their seats in the spectator galleries high up over the assembly chamber, the reformers could see him roaming the narrow aisles between the legislators' desks, pleading, cajoling, threatening, bargaining, dealing, trading votes, using every trick he had learned in his years of working for Tammany. Smith's debating ability was already legendary, But never, observers wrote, had he spoken like this. During a debate on a bill that would have required one day's rest in seven for women and children, Republican legislators beholden to cannery interests pleaded for exemptions for canneries. Smith waited until every Republican had finished. Then he rose and walked between their desks down to the well of the chamber. Whirling to face them, he said quietly, "I have read carefully the commandment, 'Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy.' I am unable to find any language in it that says, 'except in the canneries.'" Without another word, he returned to his seat. On another occasion, the man whose mother had once feared that her son would be taken from her rose to speak on widows' pensions. "Mr. Speaker, what happens when death takes from the family their provider? The widowed mother goes to the police court or to the charity organization, and her children are committed to an institution, and from the moment the judge signs the commitment, the people of the city of New York are bound for their support. Let us see what effect this has upon the state itself. The mother stands in the police court. She witnesses the separation of herself and her children. They are torn away from her and given over to the custody of an institution, and nothing is left for her to do but to go out into the world and make her own living. What must be her feelings? What must be her idea of the state's policy when she sees these children separated from her by due process of law, particularly when she must remember that for every one of them she went down into the valley of death, that a new pair of eyes might look out upon the world? What can be the feelings in the hearts of the children themselves, separated from their mother by what they must learn in after years was due process of law, when they must in after years learn to know what the state's policy was with respect to their unfortunate condition? That is the old system. That is the dark day we are walking away from. That is the period that by this policy we are attempting to forget. What new policy does this bill inaugurate? What new system does this bill inaugurate? The state of New York reaches out to them. We recognize in you a resource of the state, and we propose to take care of you, not as a matter of charity, but as a government and public duty. What a different feeling that must put into the hearts of the mother and the children! What better citizens that policy must make! Why? Because it instills into that young heart a love, a reverence, and a devotion for the state of New York and its sovereign power. We are pledged to conserve the natural resources of the state. Millions of dollars of the taxpayers' money, untold and uncounted millions, have been poured into that channel. We have been in a great hurry to legislate for the interests. We have been slow to legislate along the direction that means thanksgiving to the poorest man recorded in history, he who was born in the stable at Bethlehem. Al Smith's eloquence was useless in the 1912 session because the Republicans had recaptured control of the Assembly. But in November 1912, the Democrats grabbed it back, and Murphy had the party's caucus elect Smith Assembly Speaker for the 1913 session. He had never dreamed, Al Smith told friends, that an uneducated Mick from the Fourth Ward could rise so high. That he might rise higher, he was to say later, never crossed his mind. He had, after all, about reached a point beyond which, in America, no Al Smith had ever risen. No Catholic had ever been given a presidential nomination, nor, for that matter, any Irish Tammany man a nomination for high statewide office. A governor or a United States senator was supposed to, in the words of one historian, present an image, in appearance, speech, and manners, appropriate to his high office, and somehow it was incongruous to think of an Irishman up from the city streets in such a post. Tammany men, while they might not say so, felt that way themselves. They felt unpolished and crude and very uneducated beside the uptowners, and they never pushed themselves forward for the top spots. As Assembly Speaker, Smith was all that Tammany could have desired, building up the organization's patronage and power, and pushing through liquor law amendments that allowed the sale of alcoholic beverages at hotels that Charlie Murphy favored and forbade such sales at hotels that Silent Charlie did not. Some observers bemoaned Smith's lack of dignity, pounding his gavel with great swings of his arm, bellowing parliamentary rulings in a hoarse gravel voice that one writer called a bull of Bashan roar. He sometimes seemed to them like a carnival barker. He sometimes ate lunch on the podium. He talked with food in his mouth. But seldom in the history of the legislature had its business been transacted so smoothly and expeditiously. Cutting short, long-winded speakers, hustling routine bills through at a rate that reporters clocked at 8 per minute, Smith was, on the high speaker's podium, a commanding figure. And if Smith fought for Tammany's bills, he did not stop fighting for the factory commissions. By the end of the session, many of them had been passed, even a revolutionary workmen's compensation measure. In 1914, the Republicans regained power. Albany was filled with high-priced lobbyists representing insurance companies. Amendments to the compensation measure were introduced that looked innocent, but that would in reality tear out its heart. All the amendments did, their sponsors protested, was provide that there could be direct settlements between workmen and insurance companies instead of enforced resort to the machinery provided by the Workmen's Compensation Act of 1913. All that they did was enable the working man to get money sooner. "And for whom are you doing this?" Smith demanded as he stood in the well of the chamber and faced the Republicans. Those of them who were his friends saw not a hint of friendliness in his eyes now. "Does the working man want it? No. Does the legislature want it? No. Does the Compensation Commission want it? Then what other interested party is there? The casualty company. That's who you are working for. The agent can shake the long green before the widow or suffering laborer and tell them if they sign away their rights, they can get so much, but if they wait, they can take their chance on getting something months hence. That carries us back to the good old days when we had no compensation law. Be honest and repeal the whole law and stop faking." A Republican legislator rose to protest, but Smith's voice cracked out like a whip. "You and your governor have ruined the compensation law," he said. "You have gone the limit for the casualty companies. The people's case is lost." Up in the high galleries that overlooked the floor, the reformers stood and cheered. The compensation law might be lost, but they knew the Republicans would never dare to touch the others now. Great advances had been secured, and more important, at last, they had their champion. Smith, the Tammany man, had made their dreams come true. They hastened to hang others on his lance. But even when Smith took up the banner of the reformers, he never put down the mace of the practical politician. He himself made no bones about this fact. If cynics said that he had recognized in child labor, disability insurance, and workmen's compensation a great political issue, Smith said it too. When someone told him that his views were antagonizing factory owners, he would laugh and say that factory owners lived on Fifth Avenue and, "There's no Democratic votes on Fifth Avenue. They're all over on 9th and 10th, where I live." Fighting for the working man, for better working conditions for women and children, that, he knew, was an issue on which you couldn't miss. The man who fought for the commission's legislation would be a man fighting on the side of the angels. Supporting its recommendations was more than good politics. It was the best politics. When he had, in some instances, to drop either the banner or the mace, it wasn't the mace that fell. In the 1915 Constitutional Convention, he fought for the Municipal Research Bureau's recommended reorganization of the state government. Of all the issues raised by the reformers, reorganization was the one he most eagerly embraced, because his years in Albany had allowed him to see for himself the almost incredible inefficiency of the system. But on the morning of August 27, 1915, Smith, who had spent all August 26th fighting shoulder to shoulder with the federal crowd for reorganization, waited in the Capitol entrance hall for progressive Republican Frederick C. Tanner, and when Tanner arrived, he pulled him aside. "Fred," Smith said, "I've got to pull out on you in this debate." As Tanner recalled it later, "I said, 'What's the matter?' And he said, 'Well, I had a telephone call from the old man last night.' I said, 'Do you mean 14th Street?' And he said, 'Yes.' Of course, this meant that Mr. Murphy had decided that the Democratic organization would oppose the Constitution when it was finally submitted on Election Day, and that it would not do for Smith to give his support to a bill in the convention when the party would oppose it in its submission. After the convention, Smith campaigned against the proposed new reorganized Constitution. First and foremost, he was a party man. Even though Smith felt that times and people's needs were changing, he did not try to break away from the party, but to change it to meet the times. Every Friday evening, Tammany's sachems would meet for dinner in a private room at Delmonico's restaurant. Now, in those meetings, Smith began to try to persuade the older men that the party should begin taking a different stance. Tammany had always held the allegiance of the lower classes with the turkey baskets at Christmas and the outings and the civil service jobs. But now, people were becoming better educated, he said. Their needs were broadening and increasing. They were beginning to ask for more and to look to government to provide that more. Tammany should become the champion of social welfare legislation. It should do so because it was the party of the people, and the new needs of the people were real needs. And it should do so because it was good politics. Why should Tammany take a chance of losing the massed votes of the Lower East Side to uptown reformers who even now were sponsoring such legislation? From the head of the table, Silent Charlie listened silently to Smith and other young sachems like Wagner. Murphy knew that Tammany must change. He knew it because of the reasons the young men gave, and he knew it because of a consideration of his own. Never had one of their own kind risen to governor or senator. Never, despite the power of Kelly and Croker before him, never, despite his own power, had a Tammany man ever come even close to the top prize in the Democratic Party for which Tammany supplied so many of the votes. Always Tammany was thought of as the party of Tweed and Kelly and Croker, of the poor from the old country, who might be fit to sweep the streets, but not to sit in the governor's mansion or the White House. Becoming identified with progressivism, becoming known as the party of social progress, would be a way to shatter that image forever. Pushing to the forefront bright young men identified with such causes, rather than with the ancient rituals of Tammany, would be a way to spawn candidates and would shatter forever the unseen but heavy chains that weighed down the Irish Catholic in America. Why, already, wasn't at least one of his bright young men as true to Tammany, as loyal, as regular as even he, Charlie Murphy, could wish, also an object of praise by the good government organizations which habitually damned anyone who sat around the table in Delmonico's? Hadn't the young man, once assailed by the Citizens Union, recently received one of its highest ratings? Hadn't he been praised in the Herald? Charlie Murphy looked down the table at the young man. He gave the okay for Tammany to sponsor the legislation the man wanted. He built up the young man's reputation by running him for sheriff of New York County in 1915 and for president of the New York City Board of Aldermen in 1917. And in 1918, he wrenched from the grip of the upstate Democratic leaders the Democratic nomination for governor and handed it to Alfred E. Smith. When Smith won, it was the 16th time he had run for public office and the 16th time he had won, the inaugural parade up Albany's State Street was led by the 69th Regiment of the National Guard, New York City's own Fighting 69th. The sidewalks along the route and the steps of the Capitol at its end were packed with Smith's neighbors from the 4th Ward. All the night before, arriving by the thousands on trains from New York, They had tramped the streets of Albany and jammed the restaurants, hoisting beer steins in toasts to the new governor and singing a new, catchy two-step, The Sidewalks of New York. Their presence was symbolic. Smith's election was the triumph of the immigrants. The oath he took on the Capitol steps the next morning, as his mother stood in the place of honor at his side, the first ever taken in America for a state's highest office in the accent of Ireland. During Smith's first term, it was not that he broke loose from his party, but that the party freed him. Shortly after the election, Murphy summoned him to his Long Island estate, Good Ground. Tammany would be asking him for many things, Tammany's leader said, but he had been thinking of what it meant to have a boy from the old neighborhood in the governor's chair. Should Tammany ever ask for anything Smith felt would stand in the way of becoming a great governor, all Smith had to do was tell him so, and the request would be withdrawn. There were to be no strings attached to the job. Smith was to be his own man. And for a start, Murphy said, Smith would not have to worry about patronage considerations. He and Foley would keep the job hunters off the governor's back. Smith reappointed deserving Republicans to their judgeships and administrative posts and brought into his inner circle reformers like Bell Moskowitz, Francis Perkins, tall, olive-skinned, mustached Joseph Proskauer, and, to lead the highway department, that trough of fatty contracts at which Tammany had been hoping to feed, Colonel Frederick Stewart Green, an urbane engineer who wrote short stories and who displayed a complete indifference to the demands of politics in the administering of his department. The governor did so not only because he shared Murphy's dream, and not only because he genuinely wanted to help the state's urban masses, but also because it was good politics. Grover Cleveland, he pointed out to his friends, had become a national figure because the idea got around the country that he was independent of everybody. Smith's policies were progressive. In his first term, he bludgeoned the legislature into restoring the workmen's compensation law, increased the state's contributions to teachers' salaries by $22 million, and fought for governmental reorganization and for shorter hours and better working conditions for women and children, for the same mixture of reasons. Smith had no patience for those who didn't understand those reasons. He had no patience for reformers who, unlike Bell Moskowitz, didn't understand the importance of practical politics in getting things done, who refused to compromise, who insisted on having the bill as it was written, who raged loudly at injustice, who fought single-mindedly for an unattainable ideal. Their pig-headedness had the effect of dragging to political destruction politicians who listened to them, of ruining careers men had taken years to build. He had seen it happen. And more important, what was the inevitable result of their efforts? Since they refused to compromise and operate within the political framework, the only framework within which their proposals could become reality, the laws they proposed were never enacted, and therefore, at the end of their efforts, the people they had wanted to help, the people he knew so well needed help, hadn't been helped at all. If anything, they had been hurt. The stirring up of hard feelings and bitterness delayed less dramatic but still useful reforms that might have been enacted. When the reformers were finished with all their hollering and were back in their comfortable homes, the widows of the Fourth Ward would still be forced to give up their children before they could get charity. What good was courage if its only effect was to hurt those you were trying to help? So Smith despised the non-compromisers, the starry-eyed idealists. He despised, in other words, most reformers. He coined words to describe them. Mushbrains, double domes, crackpots, goo-goos. Al Smith despised, in short, what Bob Moses had been. But he didn't despise Moses. There were other reformers who were personally friendly to the governor and who were vital to his political future, men his own age, like wealthy Abram Elkus, and men Moses' age, like Proskauer. But Elkus and Proskauer were seldom, if ever, invited up to the Oliver Street flat for dinner. For Moses, during 1921 and 1922, the invitations came more and more often. If, after dinner, old cronies from the neighborhood would drop by and take Smith out to the local taverns for a drink and a song or two around the backroom piano, Smith always insisted that Moses come along. In fact, discovering that Moses had a passable bass to go with his tenor, he insisted that Moses be a part of whatever quartet was hastily arranged for the evening's barber shopping, and when Moses tried to beg off, Smith would drag him out of his seat and make him